take 5 minutes or so, and if people have observations or thoughts.
I recently went to a poetry reading. Coleman Barks, who is the foremost translator of Rumi, one interesting thing he said was that Rumi is the most widely recited in Afghanistan and the most widely read poet in the United States. And I keep thinking of a line that Barks said, or he read of Rumi's, that was, "That which causes the rose to bloom resides in me, or in my chest." And it keeps coming to me in everything that you're saying, so just wanted to share it.
Many of you know that Rumi is one of the great teachers in my life. I opened this book, The 10 Secrets for Success and Inner Peace, with an observation from Rumi. I often have quoted the poem that he said about love. He said, "When I heard my first love story, I started looking for you. And then I realized how foolish that was." He said, "Lovers do not finally find themselves. They are in each other all along." And the observation I made at the beginning of this book was also from Rumi, where he used a metaphor of a wine glass. He said, "Take sips of this pure wine being poured. Don't mind that you've been given a dirty cup." The pure wine, of course, is the essence of God. The dirty cup is all of the stuff around you, including your own body and all of its imperfections. Don't mind that. Take sips of this pure wine being formed. And Rumi probably is. I mean, he was born in a place that is contemporary Afghanistan, or Turkey. I guess it's Turkey today. And he's probably as well known in the Muslim world as Shakespeare is in the Western world, as far as being the master of the language. He made many wonderful and powerful observations. And I think what you've just cited is very relevant, that there's only one power in the universe, and that power makes us all what we are and allows the roses to bloom and allows our hearts to beat and circulates our food and grows our fingernails. Many times after the events of September the 11th on MSNBC and NBC, I was asked about a spiritual solution to every problem, because that book was released on the 11th of September, 2001. And there was a full-page ad in the USA Today, the America's newspaper, saying there's a spiritual solution to every problem. It hit the newsstands at about 6 a.m. And 3 hours later, our country was changed forever. And there I was talking about that. And one of the observations that I repeatedly made was that in our world, if we were alive in 1775, we would all have been told to hate the English. They were our hated enemies. We hated them with a bitter passion. And then 30 years later, it was the French that we hated. And 40 years later, it was the people in the North hating this people in the South, and vice versa. 30 years after that, we hated all the Spanish people. 20 years later, it was the Germans we all hated. 20 more years later, it was the Japanese and the Germans. And then it was the Russians. And then it was the Iranians. And then it was the Iraqis. And then it was the Taliban. And the faces of who we are told to hate just keep changing. But the enemy is hatred itself. And until we get that and practice that, and Rumi taught us that the same force that grows your fingernails grows everyone else's as well. All right, this third principle that is one of the most relevant, particularly for young people, is called, you can't give away what you don't have. And it seems obvious when you say something like, you can't give away what you don't have, that if you don't have something, you can't give it away. But you'd be surprised at how many people struggle with this idea and with this concept of trying to find out why the things that they would like to have in their life just don't show up. If you don't have love for yourself and carry around love for yourself and carry around this higher energy of love, you obviously can't give it away. And I speak a lot about energy, and I want to speak about energy here in this particular principle, particularly as we think about the extra mile and it not being crowded. That everything in the universe is energy. And energy doesn't come in good and bad, and it doesn't come in right and wrong. It comes in high and low, and it comes in fast and slow. And that very quickly and very simply, energy moves from low to high. And that energy moves like the world of the solid, which we think of as stationary, is really nothing more than energy that has been slowed down so that it vibrates approximately to the frequency of your senses. So that the reason that your hand appears to be solid is not because it's solid at all, but because your eyes, which observe it, are vibrating at approximately the same frequency as that which you are observing. Because you know that if you take your hand and put it under a microscope and turn up the magnification, you're going to see a dance. And the more magnification you get, the more dance of particles that you get. First you'll get molecules, then you take a molecular microscope and you turn that up, and you see inside the molecules there are atoms. You take an atomic microscope and you turn up the magnification, and inside the atoms of this thing called your hand, there are electrons and neutrons and protons and so on. Then you turn up the magnification on the electron microscope and you find that there are subatomic particles. And then you turn up the magnification further on these quarks and you find out that they're tinier particles. And until you put them in a particle accelerator, these tiniest particles, and you ram them together at 250,000 miles an hour until they collide, and then you open up the particle accelerator and you look inside and you discover there are no particles, that everything is just energy. And it goes back to what St. Paul said, that which is seen hath not come from that which doth appear. That everything in the universe is just energy, and it's just everything is moving, but some things move faster than others. So that the world of the solid is a very slowed down energy. It's just energy that's been slowed down. It approximates the frequency at which your eyes and your ears are processing and picking up things. And then you move to a faster energy, which is the energy of sound. And the energy of sound is nothing more than sound waves that are out there. We can't see them, we can't get a hold of them, but you just take an oscilloscope and an audiologist and you can pick up the sounds, and the sounds, sound energy just goes high, and it goes low, and it goes fast, and it goes slow, but it doesn't come in problems. There are no problems in what you hear or what you see. There's only energy moving fast and slow, high and low. It only becomes a problem when you process it in a certain way. And then we move to a faster energy, the energy of light, which moves faster than the energy of sound. And then we move to the energy of thoughts, and every thought that we have has an energy. And in a wonderful book called Power Versus Force, Dr. David Hawkins has elaborated a system called a map of consciousness in which they identify every thought that we have and its energy component. So that lower energy, that a thought of shame, for example, and a thought of hate, and a thought of fear, and a thought of stress, any of these kinds of lower energy thoughts are thoughts that weaken us. And I'll talk more about these in the last principle in this program, the 10th principle. And then we get to looking at what thoughts and what energy they have, and why would I have certain thoughts if they weaken us, until ultimately we get to the fastest and the highest energy in the universe, which is the theory upon which a spiritual solution to every problem is based, the notion that spiritual energy is the fastest energy in the universe. And that when we bring the energy of spirit to the presence of the energy of problems, because all of our problems show up in the world of form, in the world of the solid. That's where we have them. And when we can bring spiritual energy to the presence of spirit, or to the presence of form, rather, we nullify that. So that if you're in a dark room and someone brings a candle into that room, what is happening is that you don't have to announce to the darkness, you'd better dissolve now, you're going to have to get out of here because I'm bringing light in here. Darkness, rather, cannot survive when light is brought into a room because light is a faster energy than darkness. And it's a metaphor for the prayer of St. Francis. Where there is hatred, if I can bring love to the presence of hatred, hatred cannot survive. And it was the message of the greatest spiritual teachers who ever walked among us, and all religious practices are based upon this idea of bringing higher and faster energy to the presence of lower and slower energy. And when we do that, we dissolve and nullify it and make it impossible for it to exist. So that if we can think and change around the energy of our thoughts, and in Power versus Force, Hawkins speaks about how to go about doing that in ways that I consider to be brilliant. And it's a book I encourage all of you to read. And there's nothing in it for me other than to have you raise your consciousness, which in turn will help to create the purpose that I've been speaking about here in this program. So when I suggest to you that you can't give away what you don't have, I'm not just simply saying if you don't have love, you can't give it away, and if you don't have esteem for yourself, then you can't see the world in a state of esteem. What I'm suggesting to you is that there are a couple of ways to look at the world. One of them is through eyes of appreciation, and one of them is through eyes of depreciation. And that most people that I have encountered in my life, and it's why I talk about this in commencement addresses and make this one of the secrets, if you will, for success and inner peace along the extra mile. Most people are spending their life looking for occasions to be offended. And when you are looking for occasions to be offended, you are a depreciator. And you will never have any shortage of occasions to be offended. They're out there all the time. There will always be somebody who will dress differently, whose hair won't look the way you think it should, whose clothes won't match, whose language is something that you don't like, whose demeanor is off or whatever. And you'll find that every day, no matter how nice a beautiful day it might be, there's still a puffy cloud that can come through and ruin it, and they're looking for that. I have a habit of running in hallways and corridors in hotels. I've been doing it for 20 or 25 years. It's just a much easier way of getting in my exercise than going outside and then having to, if I'm in a cold climate, having to take a lot of extra clothing with me and so on. Pair of shorts, pair of running shoes, off you go up and down the corridor. An hour goes by. It's air conditioned. The carpeting is nice. And you get your heart rate up and all of the things that you are doing this for. And it's just a wonderful practice. And I've been doing it in hotels, and I have a whole idea inside of me of how to go about doing that before I start, because I invariably am going to run into people who are going to not like my being in the hallways. And it isn't because I'm in the hallways, it's because they have a strong expectancy that has been disconfirmed. And their strong expectancy is that a hallway is not a place where you run into a sweaty body. That's a place you're supposed to be in a gym, or you're supposed to be in a workout room, or out on the street, but not here in the hallway. So some people will walk out of their rooms, and they will look at me, and they'll see me, and then on their way, they have just found an occasion to be offended. And on their way to the elevators, when I'm already past, and they assume that I can't hear them, they don't know I'm psychic. I will hear them saying, isn't that disgusting? Isn't that awful? And what is that person doing? And how could he be? Doesn't he realize what? Blah, blah. And their day, and they're on the elevator, they're downstairs, they're having breakfast, they're in the afternoon, they're talking to their wife, they're yelling at their kids, and it's all because they saw this guy running in the hallways or something like that, or somebody drove a certain way on the freeway or whatever it might be. And then there are other people who are looking for occasions to be happy. And appreciators. And I'll walk out of I'll hear a door turn, and invariably I don't make eye contact with people when I'm running in hallways. I just find it's just a whole lot easier to just keep going. But I've always been amused by this. Sudden people come out and say, what a terrific idea! I never thought of that myself. Well, that's great. I'm going to go out. I'm going to go out and do my running right here. I didn't think I could run. And you'll hear them, instead of being offended, they're appreciating it. And one of my favorite experiences I ever had running up and down the corridors of a hotel was a woman. She had to be 90 if she was a day. And she came out and she had a little cane and she was sort of, and she saw me running in the hallway. And she looked at me and she said, stop. I said, yes, ma'am. She said, you're running in the hallway. I said, that's right. She said, you know, if you've got that much energy, why don't you run in into my room and be with me for a little while? Well, that's my idea of someone who's got an attitude of appreciation rather than one of depreciation. And she, all the way down the corridor, I escorted her down there, and she just thought it was fantastic. She said, that is great. I love that much energy. Are you always that up? Are you always, you know? So that what I'm speaking about here in this third principle is I'm speaking about something called, what I call, the law of attraction. And the law of attraction is something that most people don't really grasp into their lives. Question. Who do you associate with? What do you read? Who do you find yourself talking about? Where do you go? Who do you seek out? What kinds of things do you watch as entertainment? These are all part of this thing called the law of attraction. And there's something that Hawkins speaks about in Power versus Force that he calls attractor energies. And it's something I'd like to suggest to you when I talk about you can't give away what you don't have. That whatever it is that you are giving away in the way of being offended or being an appreciator, and by the way, appreciation versus depreciation is the highest form of energy that you can have to your thoughts. In other words, every time you have a thought of depreciation, you have weakened yourself in some form, any kind of a thought of depreciation. Whereas if you can shift a thought of depreciation into one of appreciation, even for that which you have been conditioned to believe deserves to be depreciated, if you can figure out a way to change and alter your thought, then you move into a higher energy. But more than moving into a stronger and a higher energy with appreciation, is that you move into a level of consciousness called synchronicity, in which you start to negotiate the presence of energy to serve as an attractor pattern. And that what I'm speaking about, solid energy as the lowest form of energy, and spiritual energy as the highest and the fastest form of energy, and that spiritual energy, the energy of love, the energy of cheerfulness, the energy of kindness, the energy of peace, when this energy is brought to the presence of the energy in which you have problems, lower energy, that these problems dissolve, they can't survive any more than darkness can survive in the first face of light, then there is some kind of a gap that you have to negotiate between the world of problem energy and the world of higher energy. And in the next principle that I'll be speaking about, called embracing silence, I will teach a meditation, and I will teach a new meditation. We'll practice it here, in which you can get into that gap. And when you are able to get into that gap, you absolutely negotiate the presence of this higher energy. And it's what I call making conscious contact with God. And that when you are able to do that, you access it much more readily. But what you have to look at here, when I say you can't give away what you don't have, is to ask yourself, if I can't give away what I don't have, it means that I am giving away what I do have. And because it's the only thing I can give away, I have to have it to give it away. So, and if energy is the vehicle upon which things are attracted and come into my life, then what is it that I am sending out there? Because it is in giving that we receive. What is it that I'm giving? What am I sending out there? What kind of energy do I send out there? And begin to look at that as the rationale and the explanation and the reasoning behind what is showing up in your life. That it really has nothing to do with what's going on outside of you in other people and in other events and in what other people are saying or doing or circumstances of your life. As much as we like to use that as an explanation and a rationale for it, that in fact, if you can change around your thinking to ask yourself, why do I keep attracting what it is that I'm attracting into my life, and what can I do to attract something different into my life, these things that we're calling attractor energies, that possibly, just possibly, I might be able to come to a place where I recognize that everything that's going on in my life, everything, I take responsibility for. And if I continue to attract the wrong people, or scarcity instead of abundance, or illness instead of health, or unhappiness rather than happiness, or fear rather than faith, and again, I always go back to that very famous prayer of St. Francis. Where there is doubt, let me bring faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. Where there is hatred, love. And if I can find a way to rid myself of those, just the thoughts, that I might possibly open myself up to a new idea. A mind that is open to everything is one in which I say that I have been responsible for attracting all of these things into my life, and now I'm going to work at it for a given period of time of attracting something different into my life. I'm going to go with new attractor patterns of energy. I'm just going to go with it and see if I can make that shift begin to take place. And this thing that I have referred to as synchronicity is something that Jung said is something that is very real and is very powerful and is something that you can access. Which means that as you reach a faster energy yourself, you see, if everything is energy and nothing happens until something moves and everything is moving, then you yourself are just a great big bundle of energy. You are just vibrating, and if you are a bundle of energy, if you buy this idea that your hand and your feet and your eyes and your entire body is really nothing more than a series of very, very tiny subatomic particles all moving together very fast with spaces between them, and you see that and you can get that, then you recognize that there's got to be a frequency at which you are vibrating. It's got to be vibrating at some frequency. And if you can also accept the idea that if I could move to a faster and a higher, more spiritual energy, that I will literally change the vibration at which I am vibrating, then it begins with the thoughts. It begins with how I am processing and thinking thoughts, that I can absolutely get to a place where I can start to radiate out different kinds of energy. And one of the things that Hawkins points out is that when people begin to raise the energy level at which they are vibrating themselves through their thoughts and through their spirit and through their actions and so on, that you impact those around you in new and more exquisite ways. And some of the most interesting experiments that I've seen are not so much on the impact of how meditation helps to raise frequencies. It's funny that you slow down your thoughts and you slow all of that down. And when you do that, you are absolutely raising the frequency at which you vibrate. And when you're able to do that, if you were to meditate yourself around a group of people and go into a deeper and a higher state of consciousness, you would raise the serotonin level not only of yourself, which are just these enzymes in the blood, which are the peace enzymes, if you will. You would raise it in the people around you as well. That all of us have this thing called an energy body. And this energy body is something that we radiate outward. And you know intuitively that there's something to this, that there's certain people that when they come into your energy field will lower your energy and they will drain some of your energy. And there are certain people, as they move in closer to you, you start feeling better. You start breathing a little different. You start having that kundalini, that movement of energy, like a warm shower running inside of you. And you sense that when other people are at these higher levels, and even animals sense it. And it's one of the things that Patanjali wrote about 2,300 years ago. He said, when you become steadfast in your abstention of thoughts of harm directed toward others, all living creatures will cease to feel enmity in your presence. So that if you reach a very high level of consciousness, which you had when you were a child, it's just remembering it, then butterflies will come and land on your shoulder. And dogs that were barking, you can absolutely bring a sense of peace to them and make them quiet down or be less vicious. And certainly you can impact it on babies. There are some people who the baby cries no matter who it is, right? I've had parents tell me that. This baby cries for everyone. I've never seen you picked up that baby and the baby stopped crying. My baby has never, ever not cried in the arms of a stranger except with you. And I say it's just bringing in a different energy into the baby's energy field. And this isn't anything that we can necessarily measure or we can identify specifically. It's just something that everybody, as I'm talking about it in the room, particularly you mothers, your heads go up and down because you know. You have a knowing about this. So one of the things that he talks about, in every studied case of recovery from hopeless and untreatable disease, there has been this major shift in consciousness so that the attractor patterns that resulted in the pathologic process no longer dominated. This is from Power versus Force, David Hawkins. In every studied case of recovery from hopeless and untreatable disease. Now, this isn't just physical disease. There has been this major shift in consciousness so that the attractor patterns that resulted in the pathologic process no longer dominated. So the question is, what is it that dominates in our consciousness? And if what we allow to dominate our consciousness is an attractor pattern of anger, of hatred, of self-pity, of fear, of worry, of shame, of these very low and slow energies, all of which are measurable. If this is what we are radiating out, we attract that back into our lives. And when we begin to make the shift away from those lower and slower energy patterns, in our natural way of reacting, even to things such as hatred, and even to things such as anger, because the problem with force is that force always creates a counterforce. And it's one of the reasons that mankind hasn't moved up hardly at all on the level of collective consciousness in 2,000 years. Because Whenever you use force, you have a very low and a very slow energy. Anger and hatred, and these are all slow energies. And when you react to that force with more of a counterforce, you have lowered the collective energy that you're in. So that if a child says to you, "I hate you," and screams that out at a 2 or 3 year old just who's frustrated, "I hate you, mommy, I hate you, daddy," and you respond back with, "Well, I hate you too," which is absurd because you know better than to do that. But if you do, what you do is you lower the energy, you create a counterforce, and you have collectively created a lower energy than when you just had one person who was at hatred or a low, slow energy. Okay? So that what you do in response to a child's hatred is you respond with either removing yourself so that the energy field doesn't get magnified, or consoling, or finding a way to let them know that I love you despite how you're acting here. And this is our instinct to do that. When bad things happen in the world, what we call bad things, which are really low energy things, when violence comes, when planes fly into the World Trade Center, when war strikes, when there are hurricanes, when there are earthquakes, when disasters, when low energy appears in humanity, our instinct is what? Our instinct is to help. Our instinct is to get into, if we're in Iowa and something happens in New York, is to get in a fire truck and drive the fire truck to New York and walk into burning buildings to save people. Our instinct is to go right away to the Red Cross and say, "Can I donate some of my blood? Let me give you some of my mojo. Let me give you my life force. Okay, here, take my blood." My blood, I mean, what a symbol that is. Take what is keeping me alive and give some of it to, and we give so much of it that we had to absolutely destroy some of the blood because there was too much given. Because our instinct is, in the moment of hatred, is to respond with love. That's our natural instinct to do so, is to seek out to help. If somebody's house burned down, and on the whole history of our people, when someone's house burns down in any village, everybody in the village comes together and says, "How can we help to rebuild your house?" And it's not an uncommon theme, is it? And it isn't just that. It hardly even makes news when there are doctors in the world who are highly trained people who could be making a fortune who go off and donate their time in places in where people don't have any medical services. The Peace Corps, the concept of the Peace Corps, the concept of reaching out and helping others who are in lesser conditions than we are, is instinctive. When a baby wakes up in the middle of the night screaming, "I hate you," only they just do it with "wah, wah," and that's annoying. I know. I've experienced that many, many times, being sound asleep and having a tiny little baby, "wah, wah." You don't look at that little baby and say, "Wah, well, wah," back right at you. You don't do that. You put a breast in their mouth, mothers, and you console them by giving them your life force and saying, "Here, take this. This will make," and it always works. In fact, I'm 61 years old. And if you put a breast in my mouth for 4 hours, I'm as happy as it's possible for a person to be. It works every time, 61 years later, right? And all of the men in the room are nodding, saying, "I know what you're talking about." Because it's our instinct to respond to lower energy with a higher energy to nullify it. But when we use force, which is what we do collectively, is why we still have wars. We use force to respond to force, you lower the energy. And an attractor pattern is nothing more than bringing a higher energy. When I have people come to me and say, "Okay, I love what you're saying. It all makes perfect sense to me. But you don't know who I'm living with. And you don't know how difficult it is. You don't know what my children are like. You don't know what my spouse is like. You don't know about the person that I work with every day who is my boss, who is just totally inconsiderate and is totally..." And I always remind them that when a great spiritual teacher, they said of Jesus, when he would walk into a village just his presence in the village and nothing more would raise the consciousness of those around him. When Mother Teresa walked into a room, the energy of the room changed just by being in her presence. When I walked into a room with Mother Mira, this beautiful soul who has an ashram over in Germany from India, and when she walked into the room and she radiates out at a very different spiritual energy, everyone calmed down. There was a sense of peace, a sense of faster energy. Not better energy. It's not about good and bad. It's not about moral and immoral. Because that's why I say you, in spiritual solution to every problem, you don't have any problems, though you think you do. The problems are all these things that are in the world of problems, the world of the physical. But if you die while you're alive, what you do is you enter into the world of spirit in which there is no form, and then you start to bring that over here to these lower energies, and you dissolve it. The attractor patterns, you can't give away what you don't have. You can only give away what you do have, but more than that, you are continuing to attract into your life the lower energies of force. Shame is the lowest energy that is measurable on the map of consciousness scale. So if you use shame with yourself, you will always weaken yourself. If you use shame on other people in your parenting and so on to try to get your children to be ashamed in order to teach them something, it will always backfire on you. And I'll talk more about that in the 10th principle. But I'd like to share with you a letter. It's a letter that I received from a woman who gave me permission to use it. And it's really about what I'm speaking about. I asked her if I could use it, shared it in some of my talks, because I think that if particularly the women listening here and those of you here in the room today were ever to encounter the kind of hatred that this woman, Ruth, her name is Ruth Carrico, encountered, it might teach you something. It was, I'm going to share the whole letter. She says, Dear Dr. Dyer, I can't tell you what a privilege it will be to meet and hear you in person, and I've been trying to figure out a way to tell you how your message has affected my life, so here goes. 4 years ago, after going back to Rhode Island for my brother's daughter's wedding over Memorial weekend, I returned to Sacramento as usual. About 6 weeks later, my brother was having problems with his equilibrium and ended up in the hospital. Within a few days, he was diagnosed with terminal cancer in his brain stem. They did try to do some special procedures, which postponed his death for a few months, but he ultimately died a year later. This was not just any brother, it was my closest and dearest family member. He was a year and a week younger than I, and we have been emotionally like twins all of our lives. So needless to say, this was quite devastating to me. I just didn't know how to handle it emotionally and could not return back to Rhode Island to see him again, although he did make a trip out here to see everyone before he died. Well, I stressed so much that it began to affect me physically and my muscles, which got weak and sore, and I was on a path to a possible autoimmune disorder. I am in the insurance and financial planning business and meet with people at their homes. One of my clients who became aware of my struggle has several of your tapes and your tape sets and offered to loan them to me. I started listening to the tapes, and the part that really was of tremendous help was when you talked about how to handle things that are out of your control and accepting things that happen in life rather than letting them negatively affect your life. Anyway, as I listened to them, I was able to incorporate them into my life, and by this time my brother died, I was much more at peace in accepting the loss. The town where we grew up and he died in is on the ocean and has wonderful beaches and shoreline. The morning of his funeral, I woke up very early and just walked the beaches and sat on the big rocks by the ocean, listening to the waves, meditating, thinking about my brother and our life together, and feeling the peace I needed to bury my beloved brother that day. I cannot tell you how helpful those tapes were and continue to be in my life. With the help of the tapes and nutrition supplements, I was able to regain my health almost completely over the months that followed. About 9 months after my brother's death, about the middle of March, In the following year, I started listening to the same tapes again, starting on a Monday morning. Little did I know when I listened to them Monday through Thursday as I worked out early in the mornings in a health club, as I have been doing for years, how they would again be such a help to me. On Friday morning, about 2:30 a.m., I was awakened from my sleep by a masked man who was holding a knife at my throat. At first, I thought I was just having a nightmare, but then soon realized that I was in real time and this person was really there, and needless to say, I was terrified. He asked me quite a few questions as he put tape over my face from above my eyes to halfway over my mouth, and then taped my hands behind my back and cut my nightgown and underwear with a knife. I realized that I had a choice to fight him and possibly get hurt badly, or just quietly go along with it and hope for the best. I chose the latter, and as he touched me, I was able to detach myself from what was happening to a degree, and then suddenly I got really calm, and I started talking to him. The thoughts from the tapes must have come back to me because the words I said were not what one would just naturally say in this situation. He told me he was from L.A. and needed money and a car to return back there. The words came out of me. I don't know where they came from. "You're such a nice young man. Would you like me to pray for you? God help this nice young man to get the money he needs to go to L.A. and help him to be happy and to have a good life." I asked him if he had a girlfriend, and he said yes, in L.A. I then asked him if he had any children, and he said no. "Would I be here if I had any children?" he said. I said, "Well, I have children, and I have grandchildren, and they are so wonderful. You should get together with your girlfriend and have children someday. They really are wonderful." I continued to talk to him as if he were a nice man. And he eventually said, "This isn't working," and never did actually rape me. He still did more, though, and I thought that this was possibly going to be the end of me, but he eventually left, and on his way out, he said to me, "You're a nice lady." I totally attribute my ability to be calm and use kind words in this situation to having listened to your tapes, which I know without a doubt came back to me, gave me that extraordinary peacefulness and strength and words of kindness. And now I want to thank you very much for sharing your life and wisdom, which have provided such wonderful alternatives to getting caught up in things. I can't say I have perfectly mastered this, but I am surely much more aware of how to handle some very difficult circumstances, and the personal growth has been very evident in how I react to life. Recently, I was again in a situation that really took extraordinary wisdom and strength to do what seemed right when others criticized. I am totally at peace now with knowing that I did the right thing, and it is resulting in life changes. Thank you, thank you, thank you from the bottom of my heart for your wonderful books and tapes. They are so much more than just written and spoken words. I am also exceedingly grateful to the person who shared them with me and have told him so. He too will be in attendance in Sacramento. That's from Ruth Carrico. Now, I don't read that because I believe I had anything to do with it. It wasn't me or my tapes. It was a different energy pattern. The energy to write and speak and say the things that I am doing right here, I'm speaking from my heart throughout this entire program. When I start speaking, I don't even know what I'll say at the end. But I always recall what it says in A Course in Miracles. If you knew who walked beside you at all times on this path that you have chosen, you could never experience fear again. And what Ruth did in that horrifying, terrifying moment that must be too difficult to even contemplate for most people, what she did is she brought a higher and a faster energy in that moment of hatred, as Francesco implores us, "Where there is hatred, let me so love." And in the worst of moments, she was able to bring something, some modicum of love or higher, faster energy, and in some way was able to dissolve it. Now, most of us won't be faced with that kind of terror or with that kind of hatred. And yet hatred is very much a part of what we experience in our lives and in our world. Collectively, mankind still responds always, almost always, to hatred with more of the same. And the faces of who we are told to hate just keep changing. While hatred itself is the enemy. Because when it's there and we respond to it with more of the same, we attract into our lives the exact same thing that we don't want to see going on. Truly, you can't give away what you don't have. But more than that, what you are giving away is what you continue to attract into your life. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Isn't that some letter? I mean, that just, I read that and I met her and I've had other people tell me similar stories in those moments of the most fear, that if you can just figure out a way to raise the energy just a little bit and bring something higher. Any thoughts, observations, questions? Yes. Carol?
I just had a beautiful experience this morning jogging early. There were a number of jackrabbits out, and one ran along with me for some of the way. So it fits in with what you said. It was just lovely.
We got St. Francis over here now, right? That's great. I have a little girl, Sage, the one who healed herself of her bumps, who whenever we walk in the rainforest on Maui, the butterflies go by everybody else, and they just land on her. And she just says, "Watch, Dad." And she has the most love for animals of any human being I've ever known. I mean, she can't, you have to escort cockroaches out of the house. She just can't stand the idea of harming anything. This is the fourth principle along the road that is less crowded. And the reason that I say it's never crowded along the extra mile is because where most of the people are, it's very, very noisy. And this principle is called embracing silence. If you want to really move into the higher levels of consciousness, if you want to understand what it means to really live a life of inner peace and feel successful in your life, then silence is something you must not only learn to be comfortable with, but something you must demand, seek out, and insist upon in your life. When I speak about a sense of inner peace, I think that if I were given the opportunity to have one of two choices, one choice would be that I could have anything that I ever wanted in the physical sense. So that if I wanted a new car or new jewelry, or if I wanted to have a vacation home someplace that is exotic, or all the money I could ever want and so on, that in lieu of that, I had to make a different choice, and that was the choice to know that whatever it is that came my way any time in my life for the rest of my life, I would be able to have a sense of inner peace, that nothing could take me away from that peace. I think I would always choose the latter. And I think as I talk to most people, when you look at why you want things, what you'd like to accumulate in your life, it often just boils down to it would make me feel more peaceful. I would feel as if I had more of a grounding and a connection to God. So when I talk about these 10 principles of achieving a higher state of peace, I'm really talking about the thing that motivates almost all of us. We'd like to know that if something happens in our lives that is terrifying, that is something that is totally unexpected, if something happens to a loved one, to one of our children, to our spouse, if I suddenly am faced with a debilitating disease myself, if all of the things that I treasured suddenly were threatened and taken away, if I was forced to deal with a lawsuit that was unexpected, if I had to deal with seeing my children go off to war, whatever it might be that we think of as ultimate struggles in our lives, is there a place inside of me? Is there a place that I can go? Is there something that I can do to bring about a sense of peace in my life? And then I can deal with whatever it is that I'm confronted with. And make no mistake about it, we're all going to be confronted with these things that are going to be struggles, difficulties, obstacles. We're going to have our expectations disconfirmed. It's going to happen. It's part of what we signed up for when we incarnated as human beings. But it doesn't have to be a problem. And it doesn't have to be something that we do without a sense of peace. And in all of my lecturing and studying and living over the past 61 years, what I have discovered for myself is that it can't be done without silence. And that silence is a great friend. And silence isn't just a wonderful experience of peace. It is much, much more than that. First of all, Herman Melville, one of my very favorite people, wrote one time that God's one and only voice is silence. And Blaise Pascal, a great scientist from an earlier century and a great philosopher, once observed that all of man's troubles stem from his inability to sit quietly in a room alone. That most of us are just not very good at that. That when we tell people to go to their room and be there by yourself, we think of that as the ultimate punishment. And in a prison, the worst place that you can go is to a place called solitary confinement. I think about a man who was released from prison in 1990. And I remember the day very, very well. I remember watching on television with great anticipation as Nelson Mandela was released from prison. And we had all heard stories about the possibilities in the late 80s of this man possibly being released and maybe not, but no one had seen a picture of him because no photos were allowed. And he had spent 27 years in isolation, 17 of them in a place called Robben Island, off the coast of Cape Town. And I remember the day that that he walked out and I saw this dignified man walk out, and all of the world's anticipation had been on what was going to happen in South Africa as a result of the dismantling of apartheid, which is an idea whose time had finally come. And it was no longer going to be possible for them to have on the books, the law books, and a law that said that one group of people, because of their racial makeup, because of the color of their skin, was inferior to another group of people. It was the last place. I remember I was a host on a TV show. I filled in for a friend of mine. His name was Dennis Holey. And he had a show on PBS at night, every night, called Late Night America. And he asked me if I would substitute for him when he was on vacation one week, many years ago. And my very first guest was a man named Dick Gregory, who was a former comedian and a man who was a great hero to me because I thought I had done something really phenomenal by running a marathon. When I completed my first marathon, I told everybody I had run 26 miles and how great that was. And I was really feeling pretty strong in my late 30s to run 26 miles without stopping in around 3 hours. And then when I found out, when I was doing the review material to interview Dick Gregory, I discovered that he ran two marathons every day for 70-some consecutive days from Los Angeles to New York to protest the war in Vietnam. 52 miles a day he ran. So I stopped. I wasn't going to brag to him about my completing one marathon and then having to sit in a hot tub for a week. And at any rate, he was a wonderful man. He is a wonderful man. And a man of great conviction and who stood up and spoke about injustices at the Hungry Eye in San Francisco many years ago. I went there to see him. And he said something to me. He said that night on the TV show, he said, "You are going to be a very well-known spokesman for the ideas that you are writing about, much more well-known than you even anticipate right now." And he said, "There's one thing that you have to do." He said, "You have to go to South Africa. And you have to talk to the people in South Africa. And the reason you have to go there is because it's the only place left on the planet in which the laws are still in place, which make one group of people inferior to another. And once those laws have been removed and abolished, consciousness will take over. But as long as those laws are on the books, people will use them as a reason to continue this kind of thing called apartheid." And I was, I don't know what year that was, but it was in the late 70s, and I was sort of flattered, but I didn't really think too much about that. But it was always on my mind whenever I would read about South Africa. I could never shake that what Dick Gregory had said to me. And then I started hearing about Nelson Mandela. And I began to read more about South Africa and what was happening there. And finally, I ended up going to South Africa in the year 2000. And I happened to be there on the exact 10th anniversary of Nelson Mandela's release from prison. And I went to Robben Island, and I went to the cell where he had lived in isolation for so many years. And I went out to the limestone quarries where he had to bust limestone in the brilliant sun. That's why his eyes are so squinted and so on. And I had a sense of something very powerful. This man walked out of prison after 27 years of being innocently incarcerated. And almost all of those years, he was in silence. Deep silence. Enforced silence. And he somehow was able to make conscious contact, in my estimation, with God. And he came out of that prison not with revenge and not with hatred and not with anger in his heart. He came out of that prison with forgiveness and reconciliation and nothing more in his heart. And it was through his conscious contact with God in that silence that he was able to find a way to turn what was potentially a volatile experience. War was predicted, because 3 million people were telling 17 million people that they were inferior, and it just looked like a bloodbath was going to ensue, not only in South Africa, but in all over Africa, which had been colonized. and had been experiencing apartheid in a, just a little different form for centuries. And this one man with this visionary consciousness that I believe came about because of his experience of silence, of getting quiet. And that when we go into that silence, we experience something that is unlike anything that we experience anyplace else. Such, I think, is the power of silence, that it was really not only transformative in South Africa, but I believe that Nelson Mandela, who left a copy of his book there for me called Long Walk to Freedom and signed it personally to me because he couldn't be there. He was up in Zimbabwe negotiating some peace between some of the tribes there and left me a note and a signed book, which I, of course, treasure. And when I spoke in South Africa, I spoke about this, and there were, I didn't think anybody would be there who would come to hear me speak. I had never even been to South Africa. And they were lined up around the block to get in. People of all races and descriptions in Cape Town and in Johannesburg. And I'll be going back there in a very short time to speak again. And I had a very strong sense that this person was in his silence, discovered something that we can all discover, something about reconciliation, and something about making conscious contact with God. So, how do we pursue this silence, and why did Melville say, God's one and only voice is silence? I think it's important to understand this intellectually, and then to go about looking for ways to bring it into your life and to understand it more deeply. God's one and only voice is silence means that God is that which is indivisible. There is no place that God is not. And you can't divide God up and say that God is on this side or God is on that side. I've often said that God isn't doing anything different now than God was doing an hour ago or 100 years ago. And God isn't doing anything different now than he will be doing 1,000 years from now. God is exclusively here and now, not elsewhere, not in heaven someplace apart from us, but here, now, and indivisible. And the word indivisible is very important, because that which is everywhere and cannot be separated or carved up is something that we have a great deal of difficulty in the world of the physical form experiencing and understanding. Because our world, the world of you listening here, is a world of dichotomies. It's a world of paradoxes. We divide everything up. I used to teach a course in metaphysics at the at St. John's University many years ago in New York. And I used to tell my students when they came in that if you could come into the room next week with just the north pole of a magnet and no south pole, you'll get an A in the course. And you don't even have to come back. And there was never a person who could ever bring in just the north pole, because no matter how thin you sliced it, there was always its counterpart. There was always the South Pole. And dichotomies are just our way of being. We divide everything in the world up. The only reason we know that something called darkness exists is because of light. If there was nothing called light, we wouldn't know anything called darkness. The only reason we have a concept called up is because we have something of its reverse called down. You've never seen a person with a front who doesn't have a back. You've never seen a person with an outside who doesn't have an inside. We divide everything. Everything is in the world of the divisible. In the Bhagavad Gita, it speaks about transcending the dichotomies, figuring out a way to get past the up, down, the male, female, the good, bad, the right, wrong, the old, the new, the alive and the dead. Everything has its dichotomy. You can always find its opposites. In fact, that's how the symbolism of language is created, through having opposites. We don't know about oneness in the physical world. Everything has its counterpart, its dichotomy, except for silence.